Thank you, Paul, so much for coming in. What story about Samuel Barber needed to be told? He won a Pulitzer twice. Everyone knows his Adagio for Strings. So what was missing in the general knowledge about him?
Samuel Barber, Absolute Beauty, is an historical documentary. And that's, perhaps you could say, something in the more traditional style of documentary films, where the ambition is to cover an entire body of work and the life of the person behind that body of work. So that was, to me, the benchmark for whether or not it would succeed on those merits. So I didn't particularly come in with an agenda or an expectation on what I would discover. I think it's important, for sure, to kind of certainly cite and give tribute to the main characters, if you will, in the film, and that would be his principal biographers. Mainly, that's Barbara Heyman, who is the writer of his most widely read biography that's actually going into a second edition soon. But following her cue, following her lead, and as explained also towards the beginning of the film, I think it's sort of investigative. And part of the fun with a music documentary is that you take pieces of music and then you say, what is behind this? What can we discover about the life of the composer through the music? And what does each particular piece suggest about the composer's life? So when you try and structure something like this to make it have a narrative arc, you try and find ways that take people along that journey, but also, again, really show the arc of the body of work itself. And so what I did was I actually almost 100% in strict chronological order by opus number go through his major works. So that plays out in the film, but that would have been a sort of boring narrative arc, if you will, just to start from start to finish. What I found is that it gave me actually a nonlinear narrative to be able to tell his life story. So we'll get, let's say, one third of the way into his opuses, and we're taken back to his childhood, Knoxville, summer of 1915. You know, it's naming a city in the South, but it's really about Westchester, Pennsylvania, and his fondness, or as later in life, people sort of tagged him as a country boy. And yet, at the very beginning of the film, Dover Beach, you also are sort of delivered this quickly. You get this impression of somebody who, even from a very young age, felt this deep melancholy and was able to masterfully express melancholy. That's the sort of depth you might expect to find after lots of disappointment, heartbreak, despair, years and years. So it started creating an interesting puzzle about the biography of the artist. But I think this investigative process really interested me, and I kept an open mind. And as I talked in particular with Barbara Heyman, and then secondly, the French biographer Pierre Brevignon, those two in particular had a wealth of archival materials and knowledge to share. And so I was able to sort of construct a lot of this around their work as the two named consulting producers on the film.
Barber comes across as reserved, but could be more expressive in his music than many of his less publicly reserved contemporaries. And there are some touching moments in the film. The letter to his mom asking him not to play football, please. I want to be a composer. The Knoxville segment, his love for his small town comes through as when you hear the neighbor talk and you hear him talk about Knoxville and how it's so much like his town of Westchester. And the composer, Jordan Kuspa, says his legacy, I'm paraphrasing, is that he's an example of a composer doing what he wants, a maverick willing to go it alone. What trends was Barber consciously bucking?
There's a few things there. One character to introduce, I think, a local character, would be a great influence on his life, and that would be his uncle, Sidney Homer. So from his mother's side, Daisy, Beatty was her last name. There was Louise Homer, a famous Met opera star of the time, and she was married to Sidney Homer. And Sidney Homer was himself a composer, and Barber's uncle was constantly feeding him encouragement to try and find his own inner voice, to not necessarily ignore the outside influences of, for example, his tutors, his teachers. His composition teacher at Curtis was Rosario Scalero, who later on in the piano sonata section, we hear him really admonish his former pupil and say, you know, here are some ways to improve this piano sonata that he wrote for Horowitz, which was very modernistic. Barber stayed true to his inner voice, and the person you mentioned, just trying to describe Barber, he called him a maverick. And so that term maverick can imply the fact that he was trying to sort of buck the idea, or buck influences. And I think that is true. I think that Barber's intentions to be, or I shouldn't say intentions, but the result that his music is so timeless, that he, for example, loved Bach and Brahms and considered those among several his favorite composers, is sort of something that you maybe wouldn't want to publicly say in the era that when he was writing music. But he had no qualms with saying so. And in fact, sort of in many ways, you can hear echoes of those composers in his work.
It's funny, there's a theme of melancholy that runs through this film, starting with Dover Beach immediately. Yet, as you watch the film, I got the sense that melancholy may be sadness, but it's not necessarily darkness, if that distinction makes sense.
That's a good way of putting it. Melancholy could sound like melodrama with the same prefix, but they are distinct because melancholy doesn't have the intention of taking you to a specific place. I think it's more of a philosophical term. I think it describes an approach to looking at the world, if you will. And so where Barber sounds melancholy, on the other hand, it's more of a view on the role of the arts, if you will. So that has to take you back to the Adagio for Strings, because certainly a surprise, again, after resisting the Adagio at first, but then having to finally grapple with it for that section in the film, the Adagio at first represented to me sadness. I think for most people it does, and we're fed that because of the fact that, again, it's certainly deployed for moments of tragedy, not only in the United States in particular, but also around the world. The most recent incidents was that at the town square in Manchester, England, after the terrorist attack, there was a moment of silence, and through some loudspeakers to a very, very large gathered crowd, the Adagio was played. It became a collective way for people to grieve. So we could call that sadness, but is it implicit in the music? And is there something about music that's inherently sad? The surprise to me was the fact that there were other people who saw it differently.
Virgil,
exactly. So I needed to figure out how to get myself out of the section of the Adagio for Strings and to leave things subject to the viewer's interpretation, but also to make it properly ambiguous. And after we get the most of the tissue of the historical background from the author of a book called The Saddest Music Ever Written about the Adagio for Strings, we also get Virgil Thompson at the end saying that the Adagio for Strings is a love scene. And he even gets a little tawdry in describing, you know, what it represents. But he also judiciously sort of steps back a little bit and says, but who am I ever to tell a composer what he's writing about? So one of the values of the Adagio for String is that it feels like, to me, architecture. It's this sort of created space. It's not pure minimalism, but it feels like it has the fundamental virtues of minimalism as a music style, where through this repetition, through this open architecture, through this lack of busy passage work, it creates a building, an architecture within which people are given room to fill with grief, with romance, with melancholy, as you say. All of these things are really the great moments to me of music. When given that space, we sit in the concert hall in the best of circumstances, hearing live musicians play this music, but we fill it with our own thoughts. Again, not a story, not a character-driven story, but we fill it with our own deeply felt emotions that come from our own lives.
And what you get is kind of a collective comforting, which is really valuable.
And another point that Leonard Slatkin makes in that section of the film is, if not the Adagio, what piece? And it's a very provocative comment, but it's sort of true. He mentions a few other pieces in other countries, but the Adagio really seems to be the one, if you really have to take score, especially in America, but also around the world. it has been the piece that people turn to when they need this collective place. Again, it's like architecture in the sense that we don't build buildings for just one person, hermits. We build buildings thinking of it being a shelter and a place where people can come together. Music at its best provides that function where we collectively experience something, but parallel to that, we fill it with our own deep feelings and thoughts from our own lives.
Right. The point is made in the film that he, if you look at his body of work, he did one violin concerto, one cello concerto. He didn't do a lot of those big orchestral works. He did one of each form. Do you make anything of that?
Yeah, the Pierre Brevignon, the French biographer, says that it's almost as if every time that he took on a particular style of music, in the case of concertos, that would be a violin concerto, a cello concerto, a piano concerto. It's almost like he said everything that he needed to say in one work. It just goes again to the nature of somebody who was not only a perfectionist, but also somebody who fully invested himself in exploring the idiomatic qualities of any given style of music, or particularly in the case of a solo instrumental work. There was a practice he had where he would actually bring the musicians, the commissioned musicians, the musicians for whom he would write the premiere of these respective pieces, up to Capricorn, which was a house he shared with Giancarlo Menotti in Mount Kisco, New York. And they would stay there and he would ask them to play a lot. And he would learn the idiomatic qualities of not only the instrument that he was focusing on for any given work, but also the idiomatic qualities of the commissioned artist and how they play the piano or the violin or the cello.
Thanks so much, Paul Moon.
Thanks for having me.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.